Consumer Privacy. Section 1, Introduction. Privacy is one of the most complex legal issues facing e-commerce ventures today. Many sites, such as the one in our case study, have little interest in actively profiling their users or discovering personal information about them. However, these sites will often collect significant amounts of personally identifiable data that may trigger liability risks. Some of this data is actively supplied by users. For example, the WGU site collects names, physical and email addresses, and credit card information through forms. Users may also voluntarily supply personal information in their threaded discussion messages, which are archived on the site. On the other hand, some of this data is passively collected. The host server records routine information about each visit. Some of the site's banner ads allow third-party advertisers to track users' browsing habits. Our task in this section is to assess the liability risk of a site's information collection practices. We can break this task down into four main steps. First, we must determine what information is collected. Second, we must evaluate the potential liability for those information collection practices. Third, we must choose whether to develop a privacy policy to disclose those practices. And fourth, we must verify our compliance with statutes or regulations. This lecture will examine each of these four steps. Section 2, Information Collection. The first step is to look at what information a site is collecting. Many e-commerce sites directly ask users for personal information through forms. However, in addition to such information, many sites also record data about their users' browsing habits. This data can be matched with personal and demographic information to create a profile of user preferences. Sites might use these profiles to target advertising or offer customized services. Or sites might engage in webmining, where different users are offered different prices based on their profiles. Users who have more money or who want a product more are charged more. Alternately, reduced prices are denied to users who shop so well for bargains that vendors will make no profit by selling to them. Attorneys must be cognizant that some e-commerce clients may not always be aware of the extent to which their site collects data about its consumers. At first glance, the site in our case study might not appear to collect much information. But if we look deeper, we can see that users are disclosing information in two important ways. First, data automatically collected by the site's server software. And second, data collected by third-party advertisers through our site. In our case study, the server software will almost certainly collect a great deal of information automatically. Most server software will automatically record a weblog of browsing habits, what pages users visit, the duration and time of those visits, advertisements viewed and clicked on during those visits, purchases made, query terms entered in search engines, and the referring website that directed the user to the company's page. Furthermore, most software will automatically obtain information about each user's IP address, computer name, browser type, email address, network owner, and domain registration. In addition to this information, our site does allow third-party advertisers to place cookies on users' hard drives. Ads on our site are placed through DoubleDealer, a fictional advertising network similar to DoubleClick. DoubleDealer uses cookies to develop long-term profiles of users' browsing habits across multiple visits and different sites. It has a profile for every user that has ever looked at one of their ads. Every time a user sees a DoubleDealer ad, whether on our case study website or on another site that carries their ads, her computer will send a note to DoubleDealer indicating what kind of website she's looking at. And DoubleDealer will store that information in her file so that it knows to send her more ads related to skiing or new age music or whatever she seems to like. In this sense, DoubleDealer tracks users through our site and all the other sites in its advertising network. As counsel to the WGU site, it is important that we recognize DoubleDealer's practices because they could create liability risks and must be disclosed in our site's privacy policy. From the example of our case study, we can see the importance of understanding the website's data collection practices. Automatic software logs and third-party cookie placements are two of the most easily overlooked aspects of information collection. Many sites have no interest in actively profiling their customers, and might even insist to their counsel that they collect no personal information. But most of these sites do collect information automatically through their server software, and many allow third-party cookie placement. According to a recent FTC privacy policy, although 57% of the busiest sites allow third-party cookie placement, only 22% disclose that fact in their privacy policies. Before developing privacy policies or weighing the legal risks of online profiling, online vendors and their attorneys should be certain that they are aware of the extent of the site's data collection practices. Subsection A, Common Technologies. Part of understanding a site's data collection practices requires understanding their technology. The two main forms of passive data collection are cookies and webhooks. Subsection 1, Cookies. First, let's look at cookies. Cookies collect information as a user searches the web and feeds the information back to a web server. An online vendor site will send cookies, which is most simply an identification number, to a user's computer, where it is stored on a file on the user's hard drive and serves as a digital identifier tag that notifies the vendor whenever the user re-enters the vendor's website. Although users can configure their browser to disable cookies, many sites require users to accept them before allowing entry. Cookies have two main uses. First, by allowing the site to remember the user, they can customize a website by producing special content targeted to a specific user. For example, cookies are commonly used to automatically supply passwords for users who prefer not to re-enter their password every time they access a site. Second, cookies are used by network advertising agencies, such as DoubleClick, to target product advertisements based on long-term profiles of users' buying and surfing habits. When the advertiser contracts with many different websites, it can follow the same cookie as that user surfs the web. Advertisers then collate this information about the user's habits into a central database. Subsection 2, Web Bugs or Pixel Tags. Web bugs are similar to cookies. Web bugs are images, usually invisible because they are only 1 pixel high by 1 pixel wide, that are embedded in web pages and HTML formatted emails. Advertising networks often use web bugs on web pages to add information to personal profiles stored in cookies and to collect statistics about how many hits a site gets. Ad networks also use web bugs in junk email campaigns to determine how many users read the emails and visited the linked site, to remove users from the list who did not open the marketing emails at all, or to synchronize cookies with the user's email address. Subsection B, Developing Technologies. Cookies and web bugs are only the beginning. New technologies are being developed every day to gather more comprehensive data on consumer behavior. I've put together an overview of some of these new data collection technologies, along with some information on privacy-enhancing technologies, such as P3P, in the background reading section. Section 3, Liability for Online Profiling. So now that we've determined what information is being collected, let's turn to questions of liability. In this section, I will focus on online profiling, namely whether sites can be held liable for using cookies or web bugs. Although the FTC has recommended legislation to regulate online profiling, current American privacy law contains almost no general prohibitions against the collection of consumer data. Today, most privacy initiatives target specific industries or types of data, such as consumer credit reports, cable TV subscriber information, or personal financial information. In our case study, the WGU side will almost certainly not face liability based on a sector-specific federal statute, because it does not collect information that falls under any of the protected categories. The only applicable federal law would be the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which some privacy advocates have argued prohibits the use of cookies without prior consent. According to this interpretation of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, or the ECPA, our site could be liable for allowing DoubleDealer to place cookies on users' hard drives. However, this interpretation of the ECPA is controversial, and many claims have failed to reach final judgment. The site could also face common law or state claims. Before discussing the legal grounds for action, however, it is useful first to get a sense of larger public policy concerns behind these arguments. Proponents of online profiling contend that collecting data about consumers allows sites to improve service. Sites can customize content, evaluate consumer reaction to products, and target ads to a customer's interests. Proponents argue that revenues from targeted ads have subsidized the current wealth of free content online. Without such a subsidy, the web may move toward a fee-based access system that will price low-income readers out of the market entirely. Legal scholars have also suggested that the expansion of privacy threatens free speech rights protected by the First Amendment. On the other hand, privacy advocates argue that users should not be tracked without their notice or consent. These advocates suggest that consumers are not adequately informed about passive information collection technologies. According to a Business Week survey, only 40% of users have even heard of cookies, and of those, only 25% were able to select the correct definition on a multiple-choice questionnaire. Furthermore, privacy advocates contend that even if most of the information currently collected is not personally identifiable, it still poses serious privacy concerns because of the inherently invasive scale of monitoring. They also worry that corporations will later decide to combine the currently non-identifiable databases of browsing habits with personal information from other sources. Finally, advocates have posited that consumer discomfort with online monitoring will chill uses of resources on sensitive topics such as abortion, HIV, or depression, and prevent the electronic marketplace from reaching its full potential. Now that we have a sense of the policy arguments, let's look at the legal grounds for action. There are three main lines of attack under which a company could be held liable for online profiling. 1. Consumer class action suits. 2. Suits by state attorney generals. And 3. Suits by the Federal Trade Commission. Subsection A. Consumer class action suits. Due to the lack of specific legislation regulating online profiling, consumer class action suits have proceeded under many different legal theories. Some plaintiffs have argued that cookies and web bugs allow unauthorized access to the user's hard drive, and therefore violate the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. Others have suggested that passive information collection is actionable as a common law privacy tort or trespass to chattels. Still others have pursued their claims under state laws, such as Texas's anti-stalking statute or California's prohibition against deceptive and unfair trade practices. Only one consumer suit filed against online profilers has reached final judgment. In late March, a United States District Court dismissed a highly publicized consumer class action suit against DoubleClick. The plaintiff's pleadings alleged that DoubleClick's use of cookies violated three federal laws: the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which prohibits unauthorized interception of electronic communications; the Wiretap Act, which prohibits wiretapping in some situations; and the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, which prohibits unauthorized access to a computer. The court found no violation of the laws because sites consented to the use of cookies by third-party advertisers. Furthermore, the court held that there was no evidence that these laws were intended to prohibit cookie use by online advertisers. The decision has been appealed to the Second Circuit, but DoubleClick still faces more suits in Texas and California based on state privacy and consumer protection laws. Despite the DoubleClick decision, legal limits on online profiling remain unclear. A California district court recently denied a motion to dismiss a class action suit against Intuit and ruled that Intuit's use of cookies may violate parts of the ECPA. Furthermore, in many state and federal jurisdictions, the use of cookies or similar technologies to track user browsing habits will be an issue of first impression. Although the DoubleClick decision may provide persuasive evidence to courts, other jurisdictions will not be bound by it, and suits may continue to proceed under state statutes on consumer and privacy rights. There are four major legal grounds for consumer suits. First, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, or ECPA. Second, common law privacy tort. Third, other common law bases for liability, such as breach of contract or trespass to chattels. And fourth, state statutes, which are usually laws against unfair trade practices. So let's look at the first ground for legal action, the ECPA. Subsection 1, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. The ECPA imposes civil and criminal penalties for the intentional interception, disclosure, or use of electronic communications that affect interstate or foreign commerce. Electronic communications are defined as any transfer of information by means of wire or electromagnetic system. Courts have interpreted the term to include email. The major obstacle to using the ECPA to restrict online profiling is that it exempts parties from liability if they obtain the prior consent of users or parties to communication. Based on the user exception in Section 2701, a federal district court ruled in DoubleClick that the ECPA does not bar the use of cookies by third-party advertisers. The court found that websites where ads were placed constituted users under the ECPA. As long as the website agrees to the use of cookies, the requirement of prior consent by users is satisfied, and DoubleClick cannot be held accountable. Supporters of the decision have drawn an analogy to the law governing third-party listening in telephone conversations. If two people are talking on the phone, either one has independent authority to consent to listening by third parties. However, critics of the decision have argued that only the consumer can give consent to cookie placement, because the consumer's hard drive is the relevant site of stored information. And at least one California court agrees. In a recent decision regarding a class action suit filed against Intuit, which owns Quicken.com, a California district court refused to dismiss a claim based on the ECPA. The ECPA has two major parts relevant to online profiling. Section 2701 prohibits unauthorized access to stored communications, and Section 2511 prohibits the intersection of electronic communications for tortious or criminal purposes. The court denied Intuit's motion to dismiss the 2701 claim, which is unauthorized access to stored communications. Although the court did not address DoubleClick's consent reasoning directly, it emphasized that users' hard drives were their own, and thus that users alone could consent to cookie use. The court held that if the plaintiff's allegations were true, Intuit did violate the stored communications provision of the ECPA by placing cookies on users' hard drives. However, the court did dismiss the claims under Section 2511, which prohibits the interception of electronic communications for tortious or criminal purposes, because the court saw no evidence that Intuit's purpose was criminal or tortious. The plaintiff's argument that cookies violated users' privacy and therefore constituted a common law privacy tort were unsuccessful in swaying the court's finding with regard to Section 2511. In sum, by examining the DoubleClick decision, as well as the Intuit decision, we can see that the question of whether the ECPA prohibits cookie placement remains largely unresolved, particularly with regard to Section 2701 and stored communications. Subsection 2, Common Law Privacy Tort. In addition to the ECPA, consumers may also sue under common law privacy tort. The common law doctrine of personal privacy includes four grounds of tort liability, which are outlined in the second restatement of torts. The first ground is unreasonable intrusion upon the seclusion of another. The restatement says, one who intentionally intrudes, physically or otherwise, upon the solitude or seclusion of another, or his private affairs or concerns, is subject to liability to the other for invasion of his privacy if the intrusion would be highly offensive to a reasonable person. Comment C of the restatement provision indicates that the section has been applied to wiretaps. However, like the ECPA, the major difficulty is that the provision applies only to information not voluntarily provided, which may bar claims where online profiling practices are disclosed in the terms of use or privacy policy. The second possible ground for tort liability is unreasonable publicity given to another's private life. The restatement of torts again reads, one who gives publicity to a matter concerning the private life of another is subject to liability to the other for the invasion of his privacy, if the matter publicized is of a kind that A, would be highly offensive to a reasonable person, and B, is not of legitimate concern to the public. There are two major obstacles to applying this doctrine to online profiling. First, the private information must be communicated so broadly that it is substantially certain to become one of public knowledge. Since most marketing data from online profiling is kept within advertising firms, the publication of personal information will often not be sufficiently wide to sustain a tort action under this provision. Second, the private information must not be of public record. Like the ECPA or the previous privacy tort, this provision bars recovery from users who provide information voluntarily or seek to protect dissemination of publicly available information, such as birth dates or marital status. The third possible ground of common law privacy tort is publicity that unreasonably places another in a false light before the public. Restatement second of torts reads, one who gives publicity to a matter concerning another that places the other before the public in a false light is subject to liability to the other for invasion of privacy if A, the false light in which the other was placed would be highly offensive to a reasonable person, and B, the actor had knowledge of or acted in reckless disregard as to the falsity of the publicized manner and the false light in which the other would be placed. The problem with finding tort liability for online profiling under this provision is that it is limited to the dissemination of erroneous information. Under this tort, consumers can insist on the right to correct false information in the databases, but they cannot claim the right to prohibit surveillance altogether. The fourth and final ground of common law privacy tort is the appropriation of another's name or likeness. The restatement reads, one who appropriates to his own use or benefit the name or likeness of another is subject to liability to the other for invasion of his privacy. This tort may create a cause of action for the sale of personal information to online publishers or unsolicited commercial emailers. However, plaintiffs have thus far been unsuccessful in this vein of argument. Subsection 3. Other common law bases of liability. Other common law bases of liability beyond privacy tort include breach of contract, unjust enrichment, and fraud. These apply in cases where express promises made in the privacy policy have been violated. The other common law basis of liability is trespass to chattels. Furthermore, in two classic texts, Alan Weston and Arthur Miller have also argued that personal information should be regarded as a form of common law property. Although this argument has not yet been made to courts, it may be made in the future. Subsection 4. State statutes. Obviously, this is a question that must be researched for each individual state, so I won't get into too much detail, about state law actions in this lecture. In general, most state law actions on online profiling have alleged violation of state statutes against deceptive or unfair trade practices. Some have relied on anti-stalking statutes or statutes offering special protection for particular classes of data, such as medical information. For more information about state statutes, please check with counsel in your particular state. Subsection 5, pending cases. In general, this area of the law is very, very unsettled. Many cases are pending in the court system right now. For example, customers have filed class action suits against Real Networks, ToysRUs.com, Avenue A, Match Logic, Intuit, Amazon, and PharmaTrack. If you're interested, I've put summaries on these pending cases in the background reading section of the website. Subsection B, State Attorney Generals. In addition to consumer class actions, the other major source of online profiling suits are state attorney generals. They have brought actions against online profilers under a variety of legal theories, often involving state consumer protection statutes. The Michigan Attorney General's office recently settled a case with eGames, an online games retailer. The state accused eGames of violating Michigan's Consumer Protection Act by failing to disclose online profiling by third-party advertisers on its site. The eGames case was the latest in a series of charges related to online profiling brought by the Michigan Attorney General. If you're interested in these cases as well, I've put summaries on the background reading section of the website also. Subsection C, Federal Trade Commission Enforcement. The third and final source of online profiling suits that I'm going to talk about today is the Federal Trade Commission. Under Section 5 of the FTC Act, the FTC has the authority to sue companies that engage in unfair or deceptive trade practices. Thus far, the Commission has limited its use of this authority to pursuing online corporations who fail to comply with statements in their posted privacy policies. It has not pursued corporations who track users' movements online through passive information collection technologies such as cookies, as long as such practices do not violate the guarantees offered in the site's privacy policy. The FTC has made clear that it does not consider online profiling to be per se deceptive or unfair when such practices are disclosed in privacy policies and users have the opportunity to opt out. In fact, the FTC cleared DoubleClick, a network advertising firm that uses cookies and web bugs to target advertisements, of wrongdoing in a recent investigation. However, if online profiling is not disclosed to customers, the Commission's stance may be very different. In its consent decree agreement with GeoCities and its report to Congress on privacy, the FTC hinted that it might consider undisclosed profiling to be per se unfair, even if the site has not posted a privacy policy at all. Subsection D, potential conflicts with the First Amendment. So that pretty much sums up liability for online profiling. Before I move on to the next section and a discussion of privacy policies, let me address one of the legal issues that has come up again and again in the discussion of privacy and liability online. Even if consumers can successfully sue on the ECPA, common law privacy, state laws requiring fair trade practices, or any of the legal grounds that I've been talking about, consumers have still got to overcome one last hurdle, a potential conflict with the First Amendment. Many legal scholars, including Eugene Volokh, a well-known scholar on online speech, have argued that privacy rules may violate the free speech rights of those who wish to disclose information, such as news agencies. Although the Supreme Court has not directly addressed the issue, the court has thus far upheld privacy laws against constitutional challenge and refused to treat the sale of personal information as speech. In Reno v. Condon, the court held that personally identifiable information constituted a thing in commerce rather than speech, and upheld a South Carolina law restricting the disclosure of drivers' personal information without prior consent. In Los Angeles Police Department v. United Reporting, the court also rejected a First Amendment challenge to a California statute that limited access to the names and addresses of arrested individuals. Like the law of online profiling generally, the First Amendment issue remains largely unresolved. Subsection 4, Developing a Privacy Policy. So now that we've got a sense of the legal risks associated with online profiling, let's turn to a new topic, the privacy policy. The first question I want to address is subsection A, why have a privacy policy? Under current American law, companies are not legally obligated to post privacy policies. Indeed, privacy policies may actually put companies at legal risk. The FTC has investigated and sued companies for failure to comply with their stated policies. Moreover, once a partial disclosure of information practices has been made, companies may even face an obligation to fully disclose all privacy policies. Although the FTC has never explicitly stated that partial disclosure triggers full disclosure, it scrutinized statements that, quote, arguably raised an inference of at least one potential use, unquote, of personal data in its report to Congress on online profiling. In other words, click here to be part of our mailing list could be deceptive if users' email addresses are later sold to third-party advertisers, even though no explicit guarantee is ever made that the email addresses will be used exclusively for the site's mailing list. Despite the legal risks, many sites voluntarily choose to adopt privacy policies. Why? First, privacy policies can increase consumer confidence in a site's online offerings. Consumers may feel more comfortable offering personal information or making purchases if privacy policies are posted. According to a report by AT&T in 1999, 27% of internet users would ordinarily be unwilling to provide their names and postal addresses for a hobby website. However, if the site displayed a privacy policy and a seal of approval from a well-known consumer advocacy organization like the Better Business Bureau, 58% of these users would be more likely to provide the information. The lack of consumer trust has translated directly into lost revenues. According to the FTC, due to consumer privacy concerns regarding online purchases, e-commerce companies have lost as much as $2.8 billion in revenue in 1999 and are projected to lose $18 billion by 2002. Second, the European Union Data Directive has provided an added incentive for e-commerce firms in the U.S. to post privacy policies. Article 25 of the directive prohibits the transfer of personal data from the EU to certain countries lacking adequate privacy protection policies, such as the U.S. However, to prevent the blockage of all personal data flow between the U.S. and Europe, the U.S. Commerce Department has negotiated a safe harbor with the EU. Under the safe harbor, American firms may continue to receive personal data from the EU as long as they post privacy policies and comply with seven main principles of privacy protection. Subsection P, Designing a Privacy Policy. So now that I've given you some reasons to write a privacy policy, let's go through the steps on how to do it. Subsection 1, Privacy Audit. The first step is to conduct a privacy audit to decide what information will be collected, how it will be used, and whether it will be shared with outside parties. There's a lot of useful guides to this process. Look on the website for more information. There are also numerous industry certification programs, such as Trustee or BBB Online, that offer seals of approval and regular auditing. I've made a list of these programs and put it in the background reading section of the website. Subsection 2, General Information on Privacy Policies. Once you've done the audit, you're ready to write your policy. A couple things to keep in mind. First, Privacy policies should be drafted in plain and direct English. If the site targets customers in non-English-speaking nations, translations should be made available. Second, privacy policies should be customized. Sensitive or personally identifiable information may require a higher degree of protection than aggregate or non-personally identifiable information. Subsection 3, elements of a privacy policy. So what goes into a privacy policy? Let's go through each of the different elements. The first element is notice. What data is being collected? How? Are cookies or web bugs being used? What is the primary use of the data? Are there secondary uses? What third parties will have access to the information? What security measures are in place to ensure the confidentiality and accuracy of information? Are goods and services offered on the website and made available only to users if they provide personal information? Will the site owner disclose users' personal information if he or she believes, in good faith, that the law requires it? If third-party advertisers collect data on consumers through ads placed on the site, this practice should be disclosed, and consumers should be informed that the site itself does not retain such information. Similarly, if data collection is outsourced to another company or a third party, this practice should be disclosed, even if the data is intended for internal use only. The second element of a privacy policy is choice. Do users have the ability to opt in or opt out of data collection? Most companies have adopted the opt-out approach, which allows consumers to choose not to allow their data to be shared with third parties or used for marketing purposes. Under opt-out, the default choice is to allow use of personal data. Under opt-in, on the other hand, the default is to restrict use of personal data. Companies are free to choose between allowing customers to opt out or opt in. Regulation requiring opt-in rather than opt-out has been struck down by courts as violating the First Amendment's requirement of narrow tailoring. In U.S. West versus Federal Communications Commission, the court struck down FCC rules requiring phone companies to obtain affirmative opt-in permission to share consumer calling patterns with third parties. The third element of a privacy policy is access and accuracy. Companies must decide whether they will allow users to access their data, correct inaccuracies, or remove information they do not wish disclosed. Companies benefit from accurate consumer information, and user access can improve consumer service by ensuring that goods are properly shipped or consumers receive information that most accurately matches their interests. However, the consumer access to data may require additional expenses, computing resources, and personnel. Online access may not always be feasible, particularly for companies that store more sensitive data, such as medical information. In these cases, written mail may be more appropriate. The fourth element is data and security. Are technical safeguards in place to prevent unauthorized access, especially for sensitive and personally identifiable information? Are sufficiently robust encryption techniques used when confidential information is stored in a file or travels across a network? Are employees and managers trained appropriately? Is data obtained from trusted sources? Is it up to date? Where appropriate, are there measures to ensure that data is stripped of personally identifying information? Be careful about explicit or implicit guarantees of security. Breaches can create legal claims based on contract or tort. The fifth element is redress and enforcement. If consumers feel that their privacy policy has been violated, how should they contact the company? What steps will the company take to resolve those issues? What measures are in place to ensure compliance with the policy? Is there an accessible and responsive dispute resolution process? Are there ongoing assessment procedures? Are the results publicly disclosed? Internal audits may be appropriate for companies that only collect aggregate or non-personally identifiable information, but third-party monitoring may be more appropriate for companies that collect sensitive information. In addition to these five elements, it's also important to write a provision about revising the policy. Is the privacy policy subject to change or otherwise conditional? Subsection 4, posting a policy. Now that you've written the policy, how should you post it? To provide notice to consumers, the privacy policy should be posted prominently. In the matter of GeoCities, the FTC developed a list of requirements for adequate notice. First, a clear and prominent hyperlink or button labeled Privacy Notice on the homepage, which directly links to the privacy policy. Second, clear and prominent display of the elements of the policy with a button that must be clicked on at the bottom of the screen to make it disappear. And three, a clear and prominent hyperlink to the privacy policy at each location where personally identifying information is collected, along with the following statement in bold typeface. Notice, we collect personal information on the site. To learn more about how we use your information, click here. At this point, the policy is written and posted, and you're done. So let's move on to the next section. Subsection C, legal enforcement of privacy policies. Now that you know how to write a policy, let's look at how these policies are enforced. Companies that violate their privacy policies may face legal action in addition to negative consumer reaction. These actions could be brought by the FTC, states, or private parties. Subsection 1, the Federal Trade Commission. The FTC does not have the authority to require sites to post privacy policies. However, once a policy is posted, the FTC has claimed the authority to require compliance with stated practices. The FTC has investigated and sued several online companies for deviating from statements made in their privacy policies. The Commission has argued that such deviations constitute unfair and deceptive trade practices for which it is authorized to seek remedies under the FTC Act. The law is not yet clear on whether the FTC actually has the authority to enforce privacy policies and whether the failure to comply with stated practices constitutes deceptive trade practices. No final judgments have been made because all relevant cases have either been settled through consent orders or are currently awaiting trial. Thus far, the FTC has sued or investigated GeoCities, ToySmart, DoubleClick, Amazon, and a series of online pharmacies. I've put summaries of each of these cases in the background reading section. Subsection 2, State Enforcement. In addition to FTC enforcement, state attorney generals have also sought to enforce privacy policies. These suits have been brought under both civil and criminal law, often invoking state consumer protection statutes. For instance, ToysRUs.com, DoubleClick, ClearStation, Infobeat, More.com, and Living.com all face suits by state attorney generals for failure to comply with stated privacy practices. I've also put summaries of these cases in the background reading section on the website. Subsection 3, Private Tort Actions. Finally, there may be suits by private parties such as consumers. Private suits have been predominantly brought under the ECPA and common law privacy invasion, as we discussed earlier. Consumers have also used contract law to enforce privacy policies. One consumer successfully sued Cosmo.com in a California small claims court for breach of contract, after Cosmo.com sent email to users who had specifically opted out of receiving such announcements. The plaintiff was awarded $50 in damages and $27.50 in court costs. So that pretty much sums up privacy policies and their liability risks. Now let's move on to the next section. Subsection 5, Statutes and Regulations. Although Congress is currently debating a comprehensive privacy legislation scheme, the United States has traditionally taken a sectoral approach to privacy. Individual statutes require different standards of conduct from different industries, such as credit reporting, financial institutions, telecommunication services, or cable television. Sensitive data, such as financial or medical information, also faces different standards of regulation. Data collection by the federal government is regulated by its own special set of statutes as well. I've put information on these statutes in the background reading section on the website if you're interested in learning more. But none of these categories will apply to our case study. So at this point, no statute covers the general collection of personal information online. Unlike the European Union, which requires databases to be registered and approved by government data protection agencies, the U.S. has relied on the market and self-regulation to address privacy concerns. However, in recent years, many in the U.S. have argued that the current market-based approach is inadequate and new legislation should be enacted. According to the FTC, only 41% of randomly selected sites and 60% of popular sites meet the basic standards for notice and choice. The Commission has concluded that self-regulation is inadequate and has recommended that Congress adopt legislation to set forth basic standards for online information gathering. So keep an eye out for new developments. I've put a link up to a bill tracking page on the website, so take a look there if you're interested in getting the up-to-the-minute information. In the meantime, there are three major statutes that sites have to worry about: the ECPA, the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, and the European Union Data Directive. Subsection A, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, or ECPA. For most sites, the ECPA will be the most important statute regulating privacy. In our discussion about the liability of online profiling, we saw that the ECPA may provide a cause of action against online profilers. The ECPA can also be used, however, to protect anonymity online. In McVeigh v. Cohen, the U.S. Navy obtained personal information from America Online regarding an anonymous user who described himself in his AOL user profile as a gay military officer. The court found that the ECPA barred the government from obtaining a user's personal information from an online service provider without a warrant, subpoena, or court order. However, the ECPA's restrictions on revealing users' personal information apply only to government subpoenas. In Terry Joseph Morgan v. America Online, the court held that the ECPA does not regulate disclosure of subscriber identities to private individuals. Instead, those seeking to preserve anonymity from private parties must turn to alternate doctrines, such as common law privacy tort or unfair trade practices. Subsection B, Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, or COPPA. In addition to the ECPA, another major regulatory statute is COPPA. COPPA applies to two major categories of websites. First, commercial websites directed to children under 13. And second, general audience websites with actual knowledge of personal data collected from children under 13. If a site satisfies either of these descriptions, personal information cannot be collected from children without parental consent. COPPA also imposes other restrictions requiring notice, parental access to information, and the option to change it, the ability to opt out of future information collection, and assurances of information security. COPPA is enforced by the FTC. However, under the COPPA safe harbor, businesses can also participate in an approved self-regulatory program that exempts them from prosecution by the FTC. Currently, the Better Business Bureau's Children Advertising Unit, or CARU, is the only FTC-approved safe harbor program. However, Trustee, the Entertainment Software Rating Board, and PrivacyBot.com have all submitted proposals for approval. Subsection C, the European Union Data Directive. The third and final statute that I want to mention is the European Union Data Directive. The Data Directive, which went into effect in October of 1998, lays forth requirements for privacy practices in member countries. Article 25 also prohibits the transfer of personal information regarding EU citizens to countries lacking adequate privacy protection laws. In January 1999, the EU determined that US privacy laws were inadequate under the data directive and therefore barred all data transfers to the US after June 2001. In an effort to preserve transatlantic transactions, the US Commerce Department entered into negotiations with the EU and developed a safe harbor agreement. Under the agreement, US companies may voluntarily exempt themselves from the data directive by choosing to follow 7 privacy principles: notice, choice, onward transfer, which means binding third parties to follow the 7 privacy principles, security, data integrity, and access to correct or remove information. These principles are enforced by the federal government of the United States and approved by self-regulatory agencies such as Trustee or BBB Online. However, very few American companies have taken advantage of the safe harbor. Why? First, the data directive permits data transfer if sites obtain prior consent from data subjects. Many US companies plan to develop contracts with EU business partners who can obtain consent from the data subjects, or to develop click-wrap agreements with the EU data subjects themselves. Second, since the enforcement of the data directive against the US is at a standstill until at least June 2001, companies may simply be waiting until enforcement is imminent before joining a safe harbor program. The third and final reason is that even if American companies exempt themselves from the data directive, local privacy laws in EU countries may still block data transfers. But as we approach June 2001, Council for e-commerce sites should begin to consider whether their clients might consider joining a safe harbor program.